Welcome back, everybody, and thank you for joining us. Before we go into some of the questions that I have for you, I was keen to hear from the two people on the stage who haven't actually presented anything. Just from listening, so Lisa, starting with you, from listening to the two presentations, with your business hat on, what do you feel the impact will be, you know, from your perspective, and what inspires you from what you've heard today? So, they're on. No, it's on.
It's on, okay.
They are.
Thank you very much, Peter and Rita, and thank you for the question, Paula. It's really exciting for me to be up on the stage talking and listening to what we saw today, because I just view the world from a spatial perspective, and everything that I saw around road infrastructure and transport contributing to smart and sustainable cities is inherently spatial. Yeah, everything is somewhere. So coming from a data and a technology perspective, I think there's lots of opportunity where we can make decisions based on better quality data, single source of truth, collaboration across agencies, and really drive this concept of evidence-based governing to enable communities to achieve that better future that Rita was really passionate about talking about earlier.
Thank you. And the mayor has told me that his name is David, and I'm allowed to call him David, so thank you for that. As the mayor of City of Swan, sitting beside you at lunchtime today, you talked about the excitement of so many things going on at the moment. But from what you heard from your City of Swan perspective, what excites you?
What excites me is planning for our future growth. Our population currently sits at 150,000. In the next 25 years, it's going to over 300,000. So that's double in the next 25 years. And we heard that lovely introduction by Kate about David Attenborough talking about 50 years ago. We've been planning a project for almost, or in fact longer than that, 1968, the New Junction project, which I'll talk about later. But I think this is the second or third time in a week that I've met with Peter and the Minister on road projects, and we're very excited because through our advocacy program with the federal government and the state government, we've been able to secure some $888 million worth of road infrastructure networks. So if it goes by rail with the Metronet and also freight lines going to the eastern states and to Geraldton, if it goes by road or if it flies into the airport, it comes through the City of Swan. At over 1,000 square kilometres, we are one-fifth the total area of the metropolitan precinct, and a lot of people don't understand that. And I'm just going to ask everyone, and you can be honest, I'd like that, put your hand up if you haven't been to Midland in the last 2 years. Okay, there's a few people. Okay, I'll touch on that a bit later on in the question and answer section. But Midland is on the move. There are many, many projects going on, particularly in the old railway workshop areas. It's being transformed into a health, education and wellbeing precinct. And I'll touch on some of those issues a bit later. Thanks, Paula.
Thank you. Peter, you talked about the new regional maintenance contracts supporting increased Aboriginal engagement. Can you give us a bit more information about the results and the impact of those contracts?
Thanks, Paula. So the refocus that we've got on Aboriginal employment engagement sort of coincided with our long-term maintenance contracts coming out of contracts. So we retendered all those contracts. They've been in place for various stages. Some have been in place for a year, some a little bit less, but we're really pleased with what we've been able to achieve. And up in the Kimberley, we've probably got 80% of the maintenance workforce are Aboriginal people, working through the contractor on the ground. There's probably 20% of the spends going to Aboriginal businesses. Up in the Pilbara, we've probably got 45% of the people on that contract are Aboriginal people, and we're putting about 10% of spend through Aboriginal businesses, and it filters right throughout the state. In the southwest, I think we've got around 20% Aboriginal people spends through the businesses there's probably about 7 or 8%. Midwest, probably similar to the Pilbara. So very, very, very happy with what we've achieved to date. We've been able to do that with the support of Minister Safiotti. When those contracts were re-tendered, we took a step that you don't see in government very often, where besides mandating minimum employment levels of Aboriginal people, we actually incentivise those contracts. So while we've got such a high response, we've got money against KPIs about actually getting people, Aboriginal people, employed, and you know, we think that's been a key driver for the success.
And you started your career up north. So personally, what does it mean to you seeing this transition?
Oh, I think a lot. So a lot of us that are in Main Rose that got grey hair and have been around for a while, we actually started in an organisation where it varied, but on average there's probably 10% of the workforce were Aboriginal people, and a lot of Aboriginal businesses, grader operators and so on, water truck operators subcontracted to us. So it's back to the future, and from time to time people ask me, why is Main Roads been relatively successful? Is that, we've got a clear vision of what success is. It's what we had for 30, 40, 50 years ago. And, when I travel around the state with Richard Sellers, there are a lot of Aboriginal people that are now working again for Main Roads through contractors, and who've said, it's great to be back, working in their home country and working for Main Roads again. And again, I'd just like to thank those people that are in the room that are tied up with, all those initiatives, because, as I said, without you guys actually making it work on the ground, you can have great policy, you can have great intent, but someone's got to make it work. So thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to be handing I'm hoping for some questions from the floor. I've got another question for Lisa and another question for David, and then I'm going to hope that there's some questions from the floor, but I do have some more that I can ask as well. Lisa, what can technology do to improve the sharing of information to help us best plan for the long-term future of the state's infrastructure?
Great question, Paula. Look, from my perspective, I think that technology is just a tool for surfacing data and making it accessible and discoverable across organisations and across multiple organisations. So I think that at the moment we have agencies that are contributing to smart cities and sustainable cities, and some of those tenants that define what a smart and sustainable city is, that it has to be safe, it has to be healthy, it has to be livable, it has to be prosperous and well run. And there's lots of data that's in government and different agencies that all can contribute to some of the measures of how do we achieve that. But it's difficult to surface that up at a whole of government level around a particular initiative. And I was just talking to Kane from Insurance Commission and chewing off Peter's ear around road safety, and we have a vision of zero killed and seriously injured, but the data for us to start driving some of the initiatives around that has to come from lots of different agencies. So the technology really can be about bringing that common platform across all these agencies to surface the data to then tell the story. This is getting a bit heavy. To tell the story and to do the intelligence behind it. So really, just technology is the tool to surface the data, but it has to be at a common level. And I think that a lot of this needs to be driven at a whole of government level. And it's very difficult to do it from individual agencies trying to do it alone.
Which is fascinating when you connect some of the themes that we've heard already today with that focus on collaboration and interagency planning, which, if there is data, which it appears there's quite a lot of data,
yeah,
you can potentially look at working with that?
There's a really great example of a project that's just about to kick off in South Australia at that whole of government level. It's called StateStat, and it's actually driven on a model that came out of the state of Maryland, where the governor there actually drove it at the governor level and brought across 500 different data sets across all of those different agencies within that state to drive and measure progress against some of the key KPIs. So the former governor actually met with the Premier of South Australia just recently, and it's been endorsed at the Premier level in South Australia. And again, it's about driving some of those key KPIs across the whole state of South Australia and bringing the data together to support that. One of the first agencies that's kicking that one off is the EPA, and they've actually developed spatially enabled dashboards at executive level, operational level, and community level, and they are measuring progress against some of those key KPIs, such as air quality. And so they have several thresholds that need to be monitored on an hourly basis, and they use these dashboards to bring in live data from different agencies, BOM and all sorts of different agencies, to report against that metric from an EPA level, and actually not only measure how they're performing, but actually push that out to the community so that there's transparency. And really, that's all around this sort of concept of evidence-driven governing. It'll be really interesting to see what South Australia actually comes, a year into this project since it just kicked off. But I think that that's something that here in WA we could be looking at that model. And yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Thank you. And David, bringing it to the local community level, you have mentioned your plans in passing about the Midland Junction. What does that mean for us here? Can you give us a bit of an overview from your perspective?
Yes, the new junction project is built on the old Midland Oval, and many of you know that Midland used to be called Midland Junction. I call it where city meets the country, east meets west. Great Eastern Highway and Great Northern Highway intersect at the Midland Town Hall, and that's why it was called a junction, a meeting place. So for many years now, the council, through its charrette process back in the 1990s, through its inquiry by design in mid-2010, and more currently through the new junction project, is looking to create a very vibrant community for residential, commercial, hospitality, retail and food and beverage areas. It's an 11-hectare site. Over 2.5 hectares will be still public open space. I'm going to mention a special project. I've got to go and chair a special meeting of council in a few hours' time. But I'd like to congratulate the investors in the area, particularly Steve DeMole Group, who's got cranes up, building right next to the Midland Oval, creating the first 8-storey high-rise in Midland. It'll be commercial on the bottom floor and then seven storeys of residential. We had a confidential briefing about another $75 million development going up across the road. So things are on the progress. It's going to have a piazza bigger than the Forest Place. It's going to service current residents in the future, but also attract people who don't live in the immediate vicinity, is the quality. And the meeting I spoke about, I'm going to chair in a few hours' time. The local family, Stefanelli family, wishes to donate $1 million to that Midland New Junction project for a children's play space area, but we need to get that confirmed by council. That we can accept the money and move forward. So to those investors, and I think while the economy is a little bit down, it's the cheapest time to buy land, it's the cheapest time to develop, so the really acute business people are taking advantage of that. Lots is going on in Midland. That's why I asked that earlier question about how many people have been out to Midland in the last couple of years. We've got a new Quest Hotel, 102-bedroom apartment-style hotel. That combines beautifully with the GP Super Clinic run by Health Integra, and they're about to open their day surgery facility opposite their current facility. Obviously, the St John Hospital's been around for a few years now, but they're also planning their new private hospital, which will be a great bonus. The Murdoch, Curtin University, Medical University is opening in about 3 to 4 months' time, so we can train doctors in Midland, and they'll have access to the GP Super Clinic and also to the St John of God Hospital. Midland is also the new home for Plus Life, the Bone and Tissue Marrow Centre, and through the Stan and Jan Perrin Foundation, they have committed to a $20+ million building for child advocacy, and that's well under construction now. There's 4 cranes in Midland operating on high rise, and we're very excited about the future. I think for the last 25 to 30 years, Midland has been a bit of a sleeping giant. It's now awakening to realise its full potential, and we'd be happy to have anyone come out and visit us.
It'll be interesting to see if we could suddenly fast forward 5 years and ask everybody in the room, have they been out? Many years ago, I published a book on the Midland Railway workshops, and the transformation began then, but it feels like it's going to be on steroids from now on.
And that's in addition, sorry Paula, to the Police Operations Centre, which occupies part of the old workshops area. They have their communications, their forensics, and their traffic enforcement group based out of those old buildings. I can't release any other details, but there's negotiations going on with the MRA at the moment about the potential use for some of the remaining buildings, including theatre, including housing art collections, and I think that the City of Swan and the MRA are working very well together, as we are with the main roads, and some of the projects that we've advocated for included Northlink. So that was a $1.2 billion project. You can now drive from pretty well from Armidale through to Nangara Road non-stop and 100 kilometres an hour. It's taken out something like 16 sets of traffic lights and 21 different speed zones. In addition to advocating getting the money for that, and that was a 10-year project in the making, and the fruition is just coming out. I believe it's going to be fully completed up to Mushay by the end of this year. The city is also successful in getting $20 million off the federal government in the last election, matched by $20 million by the state government to build a new bridge to connect Midland to Hazelmere, just near the at the rear of the St John of God Hospital. So connecting our industrial area into the centre of the CBD, it will save on transport costs and time, because there's nothing more frustrating sitting in a traffic jam, is there? I mean, if you're travelling down to Mandurah. But in addition to that, we've got $188 million funded for 2 interchanges on Roe Highway at the Great Eastern Highway bypass.
I don't think anybody's sleeping in Midland at the moment. There's so much happening.
As I said, it's an exciting place to be. It's starting to realise its full potential. And that's why I said, if you haven't been there for a couple of years, you're actually missing out.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? John Poulson.
Thank you. This is a question actually to all the panel members, and it's, I suppose, looking a little bit into the future. And, you know, roads are very traditional forms of transport, and then looked like they were fading away, then up comes autonomous vehicles. And now I saw recently that Uber's looking in, I can't remember which, I think it's in Melbourne, in, flying vehicles. How do you see the future of roads in light of all these interesting changes coming?
Peter, let's start with you.
No, thanks, Paula. It's a great question, and one thing, following the evolution of autonomous vehicles, over the last 5 or 6 years, they're going to be fully operational. I mean, to be fully operational, a lot of people are saying the end of next year, and others are saying it's probably going to be 10 years out. But one thing I do know with transport on demand, autonomous vehicles, the road network is still going to be there. there's going to be some different demands on the road network, how it's marked, how it's identified. Hopefully, you know, the big outcome will be there'll be less congestion. You know, we haven't got drivers making decisions about or leaving at the same time, and people not needing to own a vehicle personally. Hopefully, it's going to result in less congestion, but definitely exciting times.
Yeah, from my perspective as well, this is all technology-driven and it's all spatial. So not only does the road need to be in the right space, but the autonomous vehicles need to be driving on the right side of the road. So that comes down to the accuracy of where things are and satellites up in the sky and navigation and drones. So I think it's an exciting time that will come and it will disrupt our way of life, but I agree with you, Peter, the roads are still going to be there and we need to make sure that the investment in the roads, because the conversation we had earlier over lunch was about reducing casualties on the road is often a bigger factor about the quality of the road and improvements on the road, despite driver behaviour and education around that, so still needs that investment regardless of what's coming in the future.
And David, in terms of your perspective, flying cars in Midland?
I don't know what the future holds, but technology is catching up fast. I can only give you my personal experience. I bought a new car a couple of years ago, and the first time it tried to steer me because I was veering a little bit too close to the lane on the freeway, it scared the living bejesus out of me because I didn't know what was happening. And then I pushed a button and it started braking for me. So I can set the cruise control, and if I get too close to the car in front of me, it starts braking and slowing me down. And on a couple of occasions, I'll admit it, if it wasn't for the bright red flashes, the brakes pre-pumping when I've perhaps not been as attentive as I should have been, I would have had a rear collision with the car in front of me. I thought they were taking off at a set of lights. They went forward and then stopped. So the technology saved me. So it's there, we have to embrace it, where it goes to, how far it goes and how quickly it comes, but I think making cars safer through technology will reduce the road toll and make us hopefully not lazier, but embrace it and appreciate it.
Thank you.
Question?
There's a question at the back. If you could just say your name and where you're from. Thank you.
Yeah, hi, I'm Kate Stannard. I actually work for Uber, but my question is not related to the flying cars. I was a little bit alarmed to see the stat up there that from you, Peter, that you serve 2.5 million customers and 3 million vehicles. So we have already more cars than we do people in this state. What do you think we need to do, or what can we do sort of in the short term to change our attitudes around private car ownership?
Yeah, I think a lot about you know, the short, the medium term solution sort of ties in with the previous question. I think once you get fully autonomous vehicles on the road, you know, I've got nieces and nephews now that don't own cars, and you know, they don't own cars because Uber and Ola have made it easier for them to move around, and you combine that with autonomous vehicles, I think more people will say, We don't need a car, and they'll just travel around using vehicles on truly on demand. And autonomous vehicles will be the catalyst for that. And as I said before, I think, you know, the research varies from, you know, in the next few years they're going to be upon us, to, you know, 5 years or worst case 10 years. But you know, if it is maximum of 10 years, it's going to change a lot of driving habits, and that's going to result in huge change in congestion. And in WA you're tied in with the minister talked about Metronet, where you've got heavy rail around nodes. That's going to make a big difference too in terms of the people that are actually on the road.
And in terms of the Uber conversation in the cities, we're very well served, but from a regional perspective, what do you see that transition, is it going to speed up, or are there other solutions from a regional perspective that you're seeing on the horizon?
Regionally, I suppose there's two pools of thought. It's some people think that autonomous vehicles aren't going to make much difference. The other pool of thought is that it's going to make a huge difference. Those people that traditionally couldn't afford a car, travel long distances, by having pooled autonomous vehicles, is going to change their life.
Yeah.
So I tend to agree with that latter thought. It'll make a huge difference, especially for our elderly people in country areas. It'll make it more viable for them to live there.
Yeah, just from my perspective, going back to what we're talking around smart communities and smart cities, one of those key tenets is livability. And you mentioned this, David, nobody likes being stuck in a traffic jam. So the more that we can do to encourage people to, you know, have that single occupant car, so it's either, encouraging cycling. I know my colleague Tom there is a keen cyclist. I always tease him about his outfits, but that all feeds into using technology and smarts to reduce the things that the community doesn't want to see on its day-to-day doing, going about your daily lives. So Uber is a great example. Investing in public transport is an example. Encouraging people to be more healthy by riding their bikes to work is a great example. So, it all sort of feeds into connecting the community to technology to have a better day-to-day existence. And I think that's the core tenet of what a smart community, a smart city is.
And specifically with Midland Junction, how is the train and public transport going to change things?
A couple of issues. We're looking at putting some multi-deck parking in, but we also want to design the building so if in the future we don't make a revenue stream out of parking cars because they'll all drive home by themselves or go and pick somebody else up, we can easily retrofit the building. So that's the sort of things we're already thinking about. But what may work in a metropolitan area certainly won't help the people who live in rural or remote areas. I've just booked a fishing trip up at Steep Point over Christmas, and the only way I'm going to get there is to drive up there. I regularly go and see my in-laws on a farm, a 3.5-hour drive into the eastern wheat belt. And actually, I enjoy driving. I've travelled to Adelaide and driven twice in the last 6 years. I used to live on the in South Australia, a little place called Penong, 75 kilometres west of Ceduna, and I actually enjoy driving, whether I'm by myself or with a couple of mates, put on a bit of good music, and it's a very good thing, driving. I enjoy it a lot.
I come from a tiny country that you can cross it in 2.5 hours, and that's my max. I find people that can get in behind a wheel for hours on end. It's kind of an alien thing for me. Any questions from the floor? Yes.
Hi, Rebecca Tomkinson with the Royal Flying Doctor Service. You've all talked a little bit about communities in transition or in change and large-scale public projects. I'm interested in how you've managed the consultation process to really enable leading edge change, because often those stakeholders can be really challenging.
Thank you. Well, I go to David first, because I think you've had a lot of consultation.
Yes, but it's not until things are starting to come to reality that I suppose people come out of the woodworks. We started this idea of redeveloping the Midland Oval back in the late 60s, I was only a young boy, and it's progressed over that last 50 years, but it's only been the last 2 years when things have started happening that you get a small group, and these are my words, not council words, a small group of objectors who want the status quo to remain. Now, we're planning 50, 80 years into the future to accommodate our future growth. To use a disused piece of land, and those people aren't familiar with the Midland Oval, there's been no sport or recreation played on it for about 28 years. During that period, The city has spent some $250 million with the assistance of the state government, providing the 7 or 8 sporting clubs that use that oval to give them their own ovals, their own facilities. And now it's time to use that space. People say, no, you've got to keep the oval there. Well, then why did we spend all that money giving every sporting club a new home, a new pavilion? So some people, unfortunately, just don't like change. They're very vocal when they don't, and through social media they can distort things very easily. But I think if you go out there, if you have genuine intent, and in fact the City of Swan, because of the backlash we were getting over the redevelopment of the Oval, sent a survey form to every house in the city. Some 58,000 submission forms were sent out, and we took the information when it came back and realised we had overwhelming support for the project. But that's sometimes the degree you have to go to is write to every house in your municipality to find out what people think, because unfortunately the loud, noisy minority sometimes have a bias and can try and obviously get you to change your mind because of the noise and the strength of their voice.
Peter, in terms of stakeholder engagement, you know, leading the management of our whole road network, how do you approach things from a stakeholder perspective?
Yeah, well, I'm probably not the right person to ask this question, Paul. We've had some successes and failures over the last few years, but all I can say where we're moving, you know, traditionally we'd community reference groups, a lot of face-to-face, mail outs, a lot of the things that David talked about, you know, people going out and talking to people. I think, and, you know, based on our experience, we're, you know, moving into, you know, some technological solutions. So the transport polio, we've got sort of my say where... when we, you know, contemplating doing a new project, you know, we've got a two-way forum where people can comment, and we can, you know, answer their comments on that platform. Social media, you know, Davis highlighted some of the things that really concern me, that, you know, there's the silent majority generally support projects, and then there are people with vested interests. Now, with social media, it's very easy for people with vested social and financial interests to sort of create a large campaign against them. So, you know, we're trying to get smarter in the social media space to, you know, counter some of those arguments. But it's got hard for everybody over the last, I suppose, five years, mm. where those vested social interests. Those small groups in the past, they need a lot of money to push their own barrow. At the moment, they don't.
And Lisa?
So we've been involved with a bunch of different agencies and organisations around this very dilemma of everybody wants to have a voice and have a say, but it's really difficult to have all the different types of people across all the... types of person, you know, what their job is, what their age is, what their literacy skills are in the digital age. So how do you get that information out to everybody in the way that they can consume it and that they can then have the voice to come back? So going back to both of your points about the noisy minority, not everybody wants to front up at a town hall meeting and, you know, on a 7 o'clock on a Tuesday evening, but it's about delivering the information in different platforms that might be online, it might be mail outs, it might be all different ways, but it's about making that, again, that data and the information about the different scenarios and the different reasons and the consequences available to people that they can consume in the way that they like to consume and be able to respond back. So that's kind of the core tenet of how technology can drive better community engagement. And that's something that we're seeing sort of a big sort of push towards now as well, is that communication and engagement two-way.
And Western Australia compared to the rest of the world, are we learning or leading in this kind of listening, using technology to better understand our stakeholders, do you think?
That's a big call, Paula. Look, from our perspective, we see a lot of great examples coming out of the US, where we've got some great examples coming out of the city of Los Angeles, where they've actually built a hub, which is around community engagement. So it's about putting data out there around different initiatives and putting different scenarios out there and inviting feedback. So in many, there's pockets around the world that are really pushing this. I think it can definitely grow. But we've seen some really good examples here in WA. So just calling out the Road Safety Commission. They last year or earlier last year put out a call around Indian Ocean Drive. There's a lot of media around it's a dangerous road, there's lots of accidents. Instead of behind closed doors making assumptions or you know, making decisions, they actually put out a publicly available map and invited the community to actually put dots on their map with community with comments and pictures that they then brought back for their own analysis. So that was a really great example of a WA agency commission using technology to engage with the community, take their feedback back on board, and then actually report on some of their findings. And yeah, it's exciting to be part of those projects. I think we need more of those, though.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts?
I think at the end of the day, you can't please everyone. So we had a number of different ways we consulted with our communities. We had week-long presentations. We had community meetings in the town hall. We had email consultation, and then at the end of the day, when people said they still weren't getting enough, we put the submission paper out to every house in the city. And because it's a citywide project, it's not just about Midland. When you get sworn as a council, you represent the whole district, so people in Gidgee-Ganup and Bullsbrook and Malaga, Balladura, the city comprises of over 42 different suburbs. So everyone had the opportunity of having their say, and it gave the city council moving forward great confidence when 65% came back in favour of the project. And as I said earlier, even in Midland, where the biggest no protest was coming from, even had a 60% in favour. So we've done lots of different types of consultation, and we're going through similar project consultation now on aged care in certain parts of the city.
Thank you. There's a question at the back.
Hi, my name is Rabina Crook. I'm from Hassel. I'm a town planner, urban designer. So what we've seen in our projects, which are slightly different to these large transport projects, is that those agencies or local governments that are doing best practice are going way and beyond the engagement that's required in a formal sense. So really trying to derive the content, the needs of the silent majority. And what we do is, from our perspective, we do it from a design-led perspective, which leads into a design outcome. But I like to think that we try and make it a bit fun as well, because people are really busy. So I think that's where it's going. Best practice is actually to go way beyond what we thought we had to do usually.
And how, just specifically, how do you do it? Is it...
Well, we had a very minor project, which is for a landscape plan for a public open space in an inner city authority. And we have gone out to the community over 8 times. So we've done a public life study. So we've been in the park for an hour every day for a full week to understand the full breadth of how people use the park. And then we've had 3 in-depth workshops, we've had pop-ups, and the local authority has again sent out information on their website. So
thank you.
It's really in detailed what is needed these days, because the expectation of our community is that they will be involved.
But I think also it goes back to the title of our event, which is talking about long-term solutions rather than short-term thinking. So thank you. Any questions? I've got a question for Peter. You talked about the Northlink and the southern section achieved that fantastic award from a sustainability perspective. Can you just give us a bit more information about that and the innovations that were actioned to deliver?
No, thanks, Paula. And I was about to say, I think Northlink's probably the biggest undiscovered secret in the WA. But David knows more about Northlink than I do, I think. So I think the secret's out. But for those of you that don't know, we're currently building Northlink project. As David said, it's the biggest project that we've ever built. It's the cost's over $1 billion. Runs 43 kilometres from Reed Highway to Mushe. What a lot of people don't realise, it's been built in 2 years. It'll be complete at Christmas. But it's the equivalent of building Mitchell Freeway, virtually the same length. It's highway standard, and I think it'll change the lives of many people in the North East Corridor. So, but getting back to your question, Paula, that project, and specifically it was the southern section that got that ISCA rating, and there are a whole range of factors that individually, they're not groundbreaking, but they roll up into a big outcome. Now, that whole project has got a principal shared path, pedestrian cycle path, 4 metres wide, that runs 43 kilometres. Now, that people in Allenbrook, when it's open, we'll be able to cycle or walk straight into the city. Now, that's got great sustainability, sustainability, social outcomes. Now, cycling's probably more reasonable, but that's just an example. And then there are other things. At the start of the project, the project team got together with the prime subcontractors, and they collaboratively worked out what are those things that we need to do together to drive great sustainable outcomes. Now, they set targets of such things as 30% less energy used in building the project, 20% less water used in building the project. The Hampton Primary School, there was always a commitment to build an underpass, but they collectively came up with an innovative way of building a very large, bright, open structure to where people going through it felt safe. So there's dimmable lights on the project, saves about 15% in terms of electricity costs. In terms of recycled asphalt, use 10% of the asphalt on the project was recycled. So it's a great example of aggregate of sort of small gains that come up to a really big outcome. And I see that as the way forward on a lot of our projects. And it starts with getting all the people involved. And generally, you've got a lot of bright people in all those organisations, and come up with some KPIs. And basically, that was how it was done.
Thank you. I know there's two questions over here. One.
Hi, John Giorgio from Giorgio Group. This question is direct to Peter. And it's not a loaded question, but what were the benefits of breaking Northlink up into three packages, considering in the original planning or procurement, I think the agency was talking about delivering it as one package?
No, thanks, John. The thinking behind it, traditionally our large projects, if you go back to the Gateway project and Perth Bunbury project, were delivered as large alliances. And Northlink, we went to the market about the time the economy was starting to dip, mining was coming off, and our great hope by breaking it up was that some of the smaller contractors may have had a greater opportunity to get some of that work if we'd done it as one alliance. And I know we've had some success, especially on the Gateway project, where we stipulated a tier one contractor had to team up with a second tier contractor to give them experience and the ability to move up the food chain. We'd done that, but the intent, the thought around it was that we'd probably get a greater range of contractors evolve and some of the small and medium-sized contractors involved. That was the thinking, John.
Thank you.
Lucky last. Hi, Renee Ruggles from Clough. Peter, my question's for you. Your presentation discussed ISCA and how Main Roads utilise ISCA. There seems to be a disparity between sustainability policies and frameworks and tools used between both transport agencies, Main Roads and PTA. Are you able to comment why this is so, and do you understand or foresee a government where they will be aligned?
Yeah, no, thank you. I suppose, you know, fundamentally, the answer is that, a previous commissioner of Main Roads was very passionate about ISCA, Menno Henneveld. So Menno was a founder of trying to get ISCA up and running in Australia, and he drove it very hard within Main Roads. And being a traditional engineering organisation, it took a lot of time and effort, but people in Main Roads get it, and they get it now, and we've just gone from there. And PTA, they understand what we've done, and they're moving in that path. I think there are other infrastructure organisations in WA like Water Corp. They understand, and I think naturally you're going to get a convergence. I suppose Main Roads was just lucky that we had someone that was ahead of his time that drove the organisation down the path that we're on. But I see a convergence across the public sector in the coming years.
Thank you. That's the last question that we have, and on behalf of everybody here, I would like to thank the ministers had to go back to Parliament, but also to thank Peter for your honesty and the integrity that you showed in terms of your vision for Main Roads, and to Lisa. It was that kind of technology conversation, but also looking in at Western Australia from outside, which ESRI as a global organisation provides, so thank you. And also to David, Mayor of the City of Swan. There's a lot going on. You seem incredibly calm, and you've got a big meeting this afternoon, so we wish you all the very best. But as you said, Midlands on the rise, so we look forward to seeing that being delivered, and I think the rail infrastructure that we're going to see is going to be transformational for your community, and thank you for giving us some insights to that.
And thank you to Cedar and Paula for the invitation today, and Peter, I'll just put you on notice that North Link is the test run for the Orange Route. So we've also secured $20 million, $10 million from the federal government, $10 million for the state government to do the feasibility study on the Orange Route, which will be another 1.6 to 1.8 transformational transport hub. I won't go into it too much now, but if you want to know more about it, please email me at the City of Swan. Happy to tell you about that future project.
It's all go at Midland. Thank you so much for joining us today.